We're going to hearken back to the last day of unleavened bread, and on the last day of unleavened bread, the people of Israel passed through the Red Sea, and they began their journey to the Promised Land. And God promised that he would free Israel. He made that promise to Abraham, and that they would be in a bad situation for a while, but eventually he would free them, and that he would bring them back to the land of promise. And he laid all of this out to Abraham, and he did so in forming a covenant in Genesis chapter 15 with Abraham. And he promised that I will give you this land that you're dwelling in, and you will, your people, your descendants will be able to enjoy that. And he made him that promise, and with the last day of unleavened bread, he had freed them from Egypt, and they began their journey toward the land of promise. And they eventually ended up on the edge of the Jordan River, on the banks of the Jordan River, and they were ready to go into the land. And it took them 40 years to get there. And it's quite a story for their getting there. And you know, as Israel began their journey toward the Promised Land, God did not mean for it to take 40 years. And we know that 2 years into it, they came to the land of promise. They were in Kadesh Barnea, and so God said, send out some people to spy out the land and look over the land and see what the conditions are, and then we will begin the conquest. Well, you had 12 men go out, and two men came back from that journey, and they reported, we can win. We can conquer the land. It's all waiting for the taking. All we have to do is go up, and under God's guidance and direction, we'll take the land. But 10 of the people who spied out the land came back and gave a bad report and said, we can't do it. The cities are too strong. The walls are too high. These people are warriors. We will never defeat them. And sold this negative view of what was going to be accomplished. You can't do it. And Caleb and Joshua said, yes, we can. But their voices did not prevail. And the 10 that were negative toward the invasion, they prevailed. The people became negative, and God noted all of this, and he said, sorry, you're going to pay a price for this. And so what happened was God said, well, you told me that your children are going to die in the land, that you're not going to be able to carry out the conquest. So what's going to happen is your children that you said were going to die and not be able to go up and take the land, they're going to go into the land. But all of you who bought into this idea that it can't be done, you're going to die in the wilderness. Because that's what they said. We're all going to die in the wilderness here. Our children, they're never going to see it. So God said, okay, we're going to follow what you had to say, and none of you are going to go up. And as a result of that, they began a 40-year journey or a 38-year journey in the wilderness. And so what we're going to do is look at a story that happens at the end of that 40-year journey. We're going to find Israel on the brink of going into the land of promise, it's a story that's is easy to read over. And probably we've read over this, but we've really not thought about what's taking place here. And we'll probably all have our favorite stories when it comes to reading through the Bible. Stories of courage and great wisdom. Stories of love and arrogance and pride and humility. And there are lots of other stories that God puts into the Bible for us to learn from. The story we're going to look at today is such a story because it shows the complexity of human relations. And you might look at it as international relations between nations. It's an unusual story in that it's a story about how people can get themselves into trouble when they're not even looking for trouble. They're not trying to cause trouble. In fact, their intentions are as good as they can possibly be. But as they make their request, it all backfires on them and creates an international incident, we might say. But it is teaches us something about human relations, and as we have difficulties in human relations or international relations, how do we resolve those issues? And we can see through the example that we'll see here how they resolved it, and it's an example for all of us to use personally in how we solve difficulties with others and how we solve problems between nations. You know, we're all to learn to be peacemakers. So how is this done? And it's interesting how the problem is actually resolved. Before we get to the story, we need to understand the time setting. We need to understand the emotions that were prevalent at the time. Because if we don't, we really don't get the full flavor of what's going to play out here. The story takes place at the latter part of the book of Numbers. And the focus of the latter part of Numbers is Israel's approach to the land of promise. They've spent 40 years in the wilderness, and now they're literally on the banks of the Jordan, ready to cross over and to enter into that land. Their new homeland is lying right across the Jordan River, which if you see the Jordan River, it's not even most of the time a very wide river. You can see across it, but there are times when it runs like a torrent and it's hard to cross. But you could see across the river. Their new homeland is right before them. They know all about the promises to Abraham and the promises that have been shared with them through Moses. They know what God has promised. And here they are on the brink of entering the land, something that they've waited almost their whole lives for. So they're looking forward to it, anticipating the opportunity to enter the land. As they looked around themselves, at this point, their family and friends who left Egypt are dead. All of our aunts, our uncles, our brothers, our sisters, our fathers and mothers, they're all dead. All of those who came out of Egypt and we came up with them, they're all dead. They've all died in the wilderness. Numbers 14 tells of the unstable-mindedness of the Israelites when God finally told them the consequences of their rebellion. And after their first rejecting going up into the land, what did they decide to do? Well, we're going to go up ourselves. Yes, God said he's not going to give us the land. We're going up anyway. And that didn't work out well at all. They were defeated and driven out of the land. In the midst of all of this, a small incident that isn't as well known as the fact that Caleb and Joshua would see the promised land unfolds in Numbers chapter 14, verses 36 and through 38. And what happened is these spies who said, we can't take the land, we're not strong enough, we're not mighty enough as an army, we're not trained well enough, we can't win this. What happened to all of them? They all died. God killed them in short order. They didn't have to march 40 years in the wilderness like the rest of the people did. God ended their lives fairly quickly. And then the people of Israel began their journey. Can you imagine the focus of that body of people as they were just weeks or months away from literally walking down the incline of the banks of the Jordan and cross that river and up the other side and begin the conquest of the land? We've been thinking about this for years and years and years, and it's never come to pass, and here we are, we're finally here. You don't think they were excited about what lay before them? In this period, God told Moses to go up to Mount Nebo because, Moses, you're not going into the land. But I am going to let you go up on Mount Nebo and look across the Jordan River and into the land, and you'll be able to see the promised land that I offered you and all the people of Israel. And that must have been mixed feelings for Moses. He had been with them every step of the way, and yet all he can do is look. He can't go across and actually experience being a part of that land. So for Moses to enter the land of promise, that's got to wait till his resurrection, when he will be a part of it. But he was not able to be a part of it in his lifetime. And he went on to die, and then they buried Moses, and they buried him in a place that nobody knew in the nation of Israel, because what would have happened? They would have become a shrine, and people would have begun to look at Moses in a way that God never intended. So God buried Moses in a place that nobody knew of. And so God ended his life, and as a result of Moses' death, then somebody had to take over and lead the people of Israel, and that was going to be Joshua. So Joshua was going to be the leader. God had designated him as Moses' successor, and he was going to lead the people of Israel into the land of promise. Now, as you think about Israel on the brink of the land of promise, we might think about, well, how are they going to invade the land? Now, if for those of you who are from Oklahoma, how did they invade the land in the time when that land was opened up? You had all of these people lined up on the border, ready to take off on horses, on foot, in different ways to be able to get their parcel of land in the territory of Oklahoma. And they're all lined up there, and the gunshot went off, and off they went, and they're all scrambling to get their piece of land. Is that the way it was going to be with Israel? As they entered into the promised land, they had all been promised the land, and they were all promised a part of it. So was it going to be a root hog or die type of a situation? How are they going to invade the land? Well, God had worked that out a long time before. Because God, when the people of Israel began to come out of Egypt and they had crossed the Red Sea, God organized them. God organized them and said, this is how we're going to do it, guys. And he set them up in so that they could travel in an organized way. And they had been doing this for 40 years. So God organized the people of Israel around the tabernacle. So you had the tabernacle, which was in the center of the nation. And around the nation, you had the different tribes that were designated certain spots, north, south, east, and west of the tabernacle. So this is how God set it up in an organized way. And he told them, you are to, when you pack up, and we're leaving, and you're only going to pack up and leave when I give you the word. So when you see that I'm moving, then that's the time for you to pack everything up, and you're to follow me. You're to follow me to the next camping spot that I will designate. So in Numbers 2, we find a precise organizational layout around the tabernacle. On the east side, so as you're looking at the tabernacle on the east side, you would have Judah as the dominant tribe. And behind Judah and were the tribes of Issachar and Zebulun. And they were always to camp on the east side of the tabernacle. And then you had on the south side of the tabernacle were Reuben and Simeon and Gad. And they were always to be organized in that way. On the west was Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, and on the north, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And this was the exact arrangement that God designated, and Israel followed that pattern throughout the entirety of their time in the wilderness. So by the time Israel came up to the shores of the Jordan, they had been well trained in this. So they knew how to set up a camp, they knew how to take down a camp, they knew how to travel in an organized way. It wasn't just a free-for-all with everybody scrambling to move ahead. So when they broke camp, they marched in that same order. And who was in front? Every time, Judah was in front. That's just how God spelled it out. And who was in back? Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So they knew whenever they moved, when they left the land of Moab and headed toward the Jordan River, then that was the order that they would march in. It's spelled out for us in Numbers 2, and it's the pattern that they had kept for 40 years. Now, they all marched together. They stopped, and when they stopped together, and they had formed a very strong bond, and they knew that this worked as an organizational procedure, and it was just a matter of routine for them. Every one of the 12 tribes knew that they had that the promised land that they were going to inherit had been laid out very precisely by God. Just as God organized Israel, he was going to give the land out to the people of Israel in an organized way where everybody received their parcel. And it was done very carefully and very thoughtfully. So the people of Israel knew that what their border was going to be. They knew their western border was going to be the Mediterranean Sea. They knew that their southern border was going to not be the River Nile, but the what's called the River of Egypt, which is down in the Negev Desert. That was going to be their southern border. They knew that the Jordan River was going to be their eastern border, and they knew that their northern border was to go all the way to the Euphrates River. That was to be their territory. It was, and God had spelled this out for them, and he was to divide that territory to them. And, you know, if you went up on Mount Nebo, you would be able to see a lot of this. Now, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 3. Deuteronomy chapter 3. And Deuteronomy chapter 3 is interesting because it lays out the last major conquest of Israel before they entered the land of Canaan. And this is where our story today begins. You think, well, you've been talking for a while, but this is where the real story begins. What I've said before was just background. And it describes the last battle before crossing the Jordan and entering Canaan and the city of Jericho. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 1. Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "Then we turned and went up the road to Bashan, and Og, king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei." And so there was a battle that took place between the Canaanites under Og and at a place called Edrei. And this is in the territory of Bashan. They defeated King Og from Bashan at Edrei, and they took 60 fortified cities in the region of Argob in Bashan, and advancing as far as Mount Hermon. So if you look at, you know, if you go through the scriptures and you, or look at a Bible atlas, you'll see where Edrei is, and you'll see where Mount Hermon is, which is about midway through the modern territory of Syria. So it's a lot of territory that they took when they defeated Og, consolidating their occupation in Gilead, Salaca, and Edrei. The Hebrews struck down Og, his sons, and his whole army, taking possession of his land. And who was going to be the last one in? They knew that because of the time that Israel entered the wilderness, God said, "Okay, I'm not the author of confusion." They were going to be able to go in an organized way. Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 2. "And the Lord said to me, 'Do not fear him, for I have delivered him and his people, and all his people and his land into your hand. You shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon.'" So this was the next to last conquest, was defeating this particular king of the Amorites. "So the Lord our God also delivered into our hand Og, king of Bashan, with all his people, and we attacked him until he had no survivors remaining. And we took all his cities at that time. There was not a city which we did not take from them, 60 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. All these cities were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides a great many rural towns." So you had these cities with bars and walls and all of that. And you also had smaller towns where people lived and did their agricultural business and all of those kinds of things that became available to them as well. It says, "And we utterly destroyed them as we did Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the livestock and the spoils of the cities we took as booty for ourselves. And at that time we took the land from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were on this side of Jordan from the river Arnon," which if you think about the territory of Israel, on the eastern side of Israel is the Jordan River, and the Jordan River runs down into the Dead Sea. And about halfway down the Dead Sea is where the River Arnon is. So they gained control of the territory north of the Arnon River. And that gives you some idea about the territory that they inherited, and they inherited it all, or they conquered it all the way up to Mount Hermon, which is a vast territory. It says, the Sidonians call Hermon Sirion, and the Amorites call it Senir. All the cities of the plain, all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Salca and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. A really huge portion of land. Moab, a cousin to Israel, dwelt from the river of Arnon, the midpoint of the Dead Sea southward. And so they continued in that particular territory. And Sihon, king of Eshbon, ruled from Arnon up to the modern city of Ammon in Jordan. And from the modern city of Ammon northward to another cousin of Israel lived the people of Ammon. So sitting between the Moabites and the Ammonites was a block of land that ran from the middle of the Dead Sea up to Ammon, Jordan, that they conquered. So Manasseh and Reuben, standing in this last staging area, looked around them and said, "This is some nice property. This is some nice property." Every tribe had its own personality and nature, and the Reubenites and a sizable portion of Manasseh were ranchers. That was their chief occupation. They were ranchers. So, meaning they were cattle raisers and cattle breeders. That was what their occupation was. And they looked at the tableland that was there around Mount Nebo and Dibon and some of the other areas. And so they saw all of this territory and they said, "Boy, this is wonderful land for grazing, for raising cattle and flocks, and it would be a nice place for us to settle." And so that brings us to Numbers chapter 32. And we'll remain in Numbers chapter 32 for the rest of the sermon, because it's in this chapter that the story unfolds. Numbers chapter 32, verse 1. It says, "Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock." So they were already involved in cattle raising and grazing and all of that. "And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that indeed the region was a place for livestock." So they, being cattle raisers, said, "This is perfect for our occupation." "The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spoke to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the leaders of the congregation, saying," so they noticed this and they said, "You know, this would be a great place for our people to dwell. So let's ask if we can have this land." So they went to Moses, they went to Eleazar the priest, and the leaders of the congregation. So they didn't just take the land, they went up and asked if we could have it. They asked the people in authority. It was going to be Moses, east of the Jordan, who was going to be part of that decision. The priests were going to be part of that decision, and the leaders of Israel were all going to be part of that. So who else would you ask than the people they went up to ask? They didn't demand it, they asked for it. "This land is perfect for our people and our occupation, which is raising cattle and flocks, and we would like to have the land." So they asked for it. It says, and they said, "Aftaroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Elealeh, Shavam, Nebo, and Beon, the country which the Lord defeated before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock." This is exactly what we do for a living. "Therefore, they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us over the Jordan." So we're happy to stay on this side of Jordan, and we would request that you would give us this land, that this would be our inheritance. So they're asking a question and asking if that was a possibility. I mentioned Manasseh, and Manasseh really became a part of this at a later time, and you will find them referred to as the half-tribe of Manasseh, referring to those who lived on the eastern side of the Jordan, because if you look at a map at where the territories of the different tribes were laid out, there was half a tribe on the western side and half a tribe on the eastern side. What they named here were the areas that had been taken from King Sihon and taken from King Og, which were further north. And the cities named were part of a long, sloping land that gently went down to the shores of the Sea of Galilee, which was beautiful grazing land. And they're asking, can we have this land? And they didn't realize that they're asking for this land. There are no negative intentions here. They're not trying to be deceptive. They're just making a request. And the next thing they know, they're at the end of a buzzsaw. Things just went completely out of control. And there was no plotting, nothing devious, no malicious intent. But as I said, they're going to be at the end of a buzzsaw. Something to remember at this very early point in evaluating this incident, we must realize that what we read is the limit of the information that we have. We don't have more information than this. So whatever conclusions we draw have to be drawn from what we find in Numbers chapter 32. So the request was without ulterior motives. There was no ulterior motive in what they were doing, no hidden agenda. They simply wanted the land if it was possible because it would be the best for them as people who were cattle raisers and grazers. So we all read the request in Numbers 32 verses 1 through 5. And as we look at that, does anyone here see that the request is anything more than a humble request? Can we please have it? They're not demanding it. They're not saying we're either going to get this or else. If we have find favor in your eyes, would you please give us this land? So they asked all the right people. They had come before Moses and they had come before the leadership of Israel to make this request. What more appropriate approach would they have? So our story begins with good intentions, but as I said, we see the buzzsaw go into effect. You know, it's not common in times of tension for people to step into something they never considered would develop into a major problem. How many of you have made a request or done something with the best of intentions and it ends up backfiring on you? Have any of you ever experienced that? Probably we all have. You know, I didn't mean anything by it. I wanted to do the right thing, and the next thing we know, the buzzsaw is going and we're being chewed up. And that just seems to be part of human life and something that we have to deal with. So right after their request, they met with the blast of emotions. So who's the one who blasted them first of all? It was Moses. Moses blasted them full throttle. And Moses could get very angry, as we see in various times in the history of Israel. And he was very angry at this request. And he saw what they were asking negatively. And there were reasons that he saw it negatively because of his past experience. So Moses blasted them, and he was accusing them of being just like the people of Israel who refused to go up and take the land. Notice how an innocent request can be perceived negatively. And what followed next, after assuming the motive, he blames them for the consequence. There's name-calling involved, and last of all, the prediction of catastrophe. And that's sometimes the way things go. And so it was a tremendous outburst, a tremendous tongue-lashing that Moses gave to them. And let's go to chapter 32 and look at verse 6 and just read what he had to say. Numbers 32, verse 6. It says, "And Moses said to the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben, shall your brethren go to war while you sit here?" So what was his conclusion? You guys aren't going to go up with us to take the land. You guys are going to take your portion of the land on this side of the Jordan, and you're going to say adios, and we're going to go up and seek to conquer the land, but you're not going to be a part of the conquest. You're not going to help us with this. You're just like the people when we came up to conquer the land back 40 years ago. They refused to go up, and here you're doing exactly the same thing. He says in verse 8, "Thus your fathers did when I sent them away from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and they saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the children of Israel, so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger was aroused on that day, and he swore an oath, saying, surely none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun. For they have wholly followed the Lord. So the Lord's anger was aroused against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone. And look, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all this people. So he sees what they're doing is undermining the conquest. He sees that they're following the same path as their forefathers at Kadesh Barnea. He says, on your head is going to be the death of several million Israelites. And you have to realize, as Israel came out of Egypt, one interesting thing to consider is that there were 2 to 3 million Israelites who crossed the River Jordan, or river, the Red Sea. But they've had 40 years in the wilderness. Do you think that they were having children as they passed through the wilderness? Interestingly, they were. And they weren't worried about birth control. So if you have 2 to 3 million people as they cross the Red Sea, that number is going to increase as time goes along. So you may have 6 to 8 million people here that have come up to the Jordan River because they've been having children. They weren't practicing birth control. They weren't trying to just have replacement numbers. They weren't worried about it. So you had 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, things that we wouldn't entertain, but that was common in their age. And so sometimes we get this idea, well, the same 2 or 3 million showed up at the border of Canaan, but it was probably a larger number than that. And it doesn't tell us the exact number, but you think about it, in 40 years, a population can grow greatly. So there were a lot of people there. So there are some lessons from this episode recorded between verses 6 and verse 15. In stressful times, motives are instantly assumed. So when something like this occurs, do we ever come to the, say, well, they're up to no good, and what you're doing is going to cause all sorts of trouble, and we come to the worst conclusion possible? None of us have ever done that, have we? But that's what Moses concluded. It's the very first thing out of Moses' mouth. He says, you want to get out of going to war to win the land. The land you are standing on is already won, and you want to just sit here on the eastern side of the Jordan? Your brethren go to war while you sit here. That was the very first assumption. But was that true? Was that true? That was his assumption. So we'll find out if that was true or not. What follows very quickly on the tail end of it is blame. So he blames them. So the second thing out of Moses' mouth is, now why will you discourage the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them? So you're not going to go up, and you're going to discourage the other members of the congregation of Israel. You're not going up. Why should we go up? That was the conclusion, he said. You're just like the rotten spies who gave the negative report. So he cast blame on the Reubenites and Gadites. He said, you're going to cause the destruction of this entire nation because of you are going to dishearten everyone. And God is not going to give us a second chance. We're dead. By your doing this, God is going to destroy us. He's not going to give us another chance. Then we move on to name calling. Look in verse 14, it says, and look, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. And what followed next, after assuming motive, blame for consequence, name calling, and last of all, the prediction of catastrophe, he says, if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave us in the wilderness. Basically, you're setting up the destruction of the nation. It was a tremendous outburst, a tremendous tongue lashing that Moses issued to the people of Israel. And you know, imagine if you were the leaders of the children of Gad and Reuben. You had no negative intentions, and here you're getting chewed out and accused. They probably stood there with their mouths agape. What happened? What happened? What's happening here? This is all going wrong. So now it's become a full-known mess, a international incident between the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the other nations of Israel. So how are you going to fix this? How are you going to fix this? How do you get out of a mess like this? A mess that you never intended. But that's sometimes how life goes, isn't it? We don't intend a mess, but the mess occurs anyway. So then we have to figure out how do we get out of it. And as you look at what happened here, how the problem is resolved, it's an instructional for you and me in how to resolve such a thing. So if we have such a thing that could happen, could this happen in our family? It doesn't have to be between nations. Have we ever had anything like that? Oh, yeah. We've had all of that. So how do you resolve it? And what they did is instructional. So this is a human story, and so we can see some lessons here. So when you have a situation like this take place, what you need is called dialogue. You need dialogue. And for a dialogue to take place, there have to be two parties involved. Both parties have to dialogue. You don't want two monologues, you want two dialogues. People are talking back and forth. They're communicating with each other. And from my experience as a minister, most of the time what you get is two monologues. They're talking, and they're not talking back and forth. I remember that in one particular case, a husband and wife, she was making her point, he was making his point, and there was no dialogue. She made her points and did not listen to what he had to say at all, and vice versa. And for a dialogue to take place, there has to be communication between the two parties. So a dialogue is what's crucial here. So crucial to dialogue is an ear that will listen on the part of the one offended and a sincere explanation of the heart by the offender. So there has to be honesty, there has to be a willingness to listen and to communicate with each other. So Reuben and Gad had dug themselves into a deep hole, so how are they going to get out of it? Moses was not the man who you wanted to cross. You know, if you made Moses angry, he did things like, okay, you guys are having this big party down at the bottom of the mountain, but you know what? You've built this idol, and I'm going to grind it down to powder, and I'm going to have all of you drink it. So Moses could get a little steamed about things, which he had done earlier, and so they had crossed Moses. And then the people of Gad, the leadership of Gad and Reuben, came to Moses once again. And Moses could have said, we're done talking here. I've made my decision. You guys are going over the river whether you like it or not. And we're not going to give you this land or whatever. I've already stated my piece. But they came to him and they humbly sought to talk to him. Because if they had not come in humility, I don't think Moses would have listened to them. But they didn't come defiantly. They came humbly. And so what they did is they came and they said, we want to make a proposal. Yes, we do want this land. We want you to give it to us. But we're going to do our part. We have a duty and responsibility to go up with the other tribes as we committed to fulfill our promise. They had promised that. They were going to be in this to the end. So they said, yes, we want the land, and we're going to go up, and we're going to do our part to help take the land. But But what we're going to do is we have a certain place in the order of march. And it's back. We're never on the front line. But here's what we propose. We, as Gadites and Reubenites, we will go first. We will go first. And you know, you look at D-Day. Those who went in first, do you think those guys were worried? Absolutely. We're first. We're the first ones they're going to shoot at. And they're worried about not making it. So Gad and Reuben said, we'll go first. We're going with you. We'll cross the River Jordan, and we will go first. In every battle, we will go first. They made that commitment. So they told that to Moses, and they said, we're not trying to shirk our responsibility, but we really don't enjoy this buzzsaw, so we're going to try to rectify the situation. And in allowing them to address Moses, we've tried to give you a plan of action that will demonstrate our good faith and intent. They were willing to do their part. They were willing to do their part. And so what we would like to do is to make sure our families are taken care of, that they're protected as we cross over the river and we go into the land. So help us to get everything in order on that front, and then we will lead the march into the land of promise. And we will be on the front line every time that we are seeking to conquer one of the places in the land. So the situation could not even begin to diffuse until the offended understood the lack of malice. So when you make that proposal to the offended, what can they say? Wow, you're going to take the brunt of this? You're going to let us go later so that more of us can survive? We kind of like that idea. And they were willing to do it. The problem could be further diffused if Reuben and Gad would show good faith. And they could have said, we did not mean to offend, but that was not enough. They were showing by their choice that they were willing to make good on their promise to see it through to the end. They were not being cowardly. They were not shirking. They were not trying to get out of their commitment. So they had made a commitment early on, and they were going to fulfill it, even though it was going to mean that more people from Gad and Reuben would die. But they felt it was the right thing to do. And that's one of the things that God looks forward to in our lives. Will we fulfill our commitment? You know, it may not be convenient. It may not be easy. It may cost us a lot to do it. But that's what God's looking for, is that we are going to fulfill that commitment. The people of Gad and Reuben next said, we have a plan to address the offended party's issues. And next to the last step was Reuben and Gad were seeking to resolve the problem in a positive way. And they would do their part. Now, who did they make the agreement with? Who did they make the agreement with? They made it with Moses and the leaders of Israel. But you know what? By the time they were getting ready to cross the Jordan, Moses is dead. That makes the agreement we made null and void. We're not going to do that. Moses is dead. We made the agreement with him. But that's not what they did. We come to the border here, and they indicate that they're going to fulfill the promise. Let's go to Joshua chapter 1. Joshua is now going to lead them into the land of promise. Joshua chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. So it says there, your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan. But you shall pass before your brethren armed, all your mighty men of valor, and help them, until the Lord has given you your brethren rest, as he gave you, and they also have taken possession of the land which the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to the land of your possession and enjoy it, which Moses, the Lord's servant, gave you on this side of Jordan toward the sunrise. So what did the people of Gad and Reuben say in verse 16? So they answered Joshua, saying, all that you command us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we heeded Moses in all things, so we will heed you. We're not going to play games. We made a commitment. We will follow through on that commitment. Verse 17 continued, only the Lord your God be with you, as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your command and does not heed your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and of good courage. So Joshua was to lead the march, and the people of Gad and Reuben said, we're going to be right behind you, and we're going to follow through on this until we complete the mission. We're going to follow through on this until we complete the mission. So they were willing to follow through on that, and they were willing to do what they needed to do to make this work. And you could see the attitude that they had. Instead of being offended by Moses giving them the tongue lashing, they came back in humility. And they figured out a way that would resolve this in a positive circumstance. And that's the key to the whole situation here. They were willing to eat crow. They didn't intend a problem. But they listened and they said, okay, how do we resolve this? And it's a lesson for all of us. As we find ourselves in one of these situations, humility is crucial to it. And maybe we need to go above and beyond the call of duty in order to convince the people who doubt us that we're actually sincere. And then when it comes time to do it, we have to do it. We have to do it. And they did. And they stayed faithful all the way to the end until the conquest was complete, or as complete as they were going to make it. And then they returned their land. So the little story in Numbers 32, the incident before they ever arrived at the border of the Promised Land, is truly a beautiful story. A story that we can learn from about human relations. The problems that we can get into, the assumptions that can be made, the attitudes that can rise. And there is a way that we can diffuse that. Humility, a willingness to go above and beyond and to make sacrifice, and a desire to make sure that we fulfill that commitment, that we're men and women of our word. So we see the sincere and genuine intent by people on both sides when they negotiate from a good heart and pure motives, which we see here. Moses had chewed them out, but Moses was willing. You don't think Moses had to eat some crow? Because he had accused them. He had to say, well, maybe I was wrong. It doesn't have that part in the story, but I imagine he had to say that. And sometimes that's crucial to moving forward. We see a demonstration of the ability to forgive the offense on the one side and to rectify the offense on the other. And this is one of many beautiful stories that we find in the scriptures. And we could easily read over this in 5 minutes and never catch the deeper meaning. But there's a whole lot more to the story. People, emotions, attitudes, actions, and sincerity that we can glean from what we find in the scriptures here. So take some time to read through the scriptures, to look deeper into them as you read a section of scripture. And you know, there are things that we can find in there that upon first glance we may not see. But as we spend time looking at them and praying about them and comparing them one scripture with another, we can see the deeper things that God wants us to see in his word. So that little story about the Reubenites and the Gadites, Moses and the people of Israel, is quite instructive. It's instructive for us in our personal relations, and hopefully we can learn from it and put it into practice in our lives. So thanks for your attention. Please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath day.